minutes, and I did it the same way every time. While it physically warmed me up to play, more importantly, it put me in the right mental state. I began to associate my pregame ritual with feeling competitive and focused. Even if I wasn't motivated beforehand, by the time I was done with my ritual, I was in game mode. You can adapt this strategy for nearly any purpose. Say you want to feel happier in general. Find something that makes you truly happy, like petting your dog or taking a bubble bath, and then create a short routine that you perform every time before you do the thing you love. For example, maybe you take 3 deep breaths and smile. So, 3 deep breaths, smile, pet the dog, repeat. Eventually, you'll begin to associate this breathe and smile routine with being in a good mood. It becomes a cue that means feeling happy. Once established, you can break it out anytime you need to change your emotional state. Stressed at work? Take 3 deep breaths and smile. Sad about life? 3 deep breaths and smile. Once a habit has been built, the cue can prompt a craving, even if it has little to do with the original situation. The key to finding and fixing the causes of your bad habits is to reframe the associations you have about them. It's not easy, but if you can reprogram your predictions, you can transform a hard habit into an attractive one. Chapter summary. The inversion of the second law of behavior change is make it unattractive. Every behavior has a surface-level craving and a deeper, underlying motive. Your habits are modern-day solutions to ancient desires. The cause of your habits is actually the prediction that precedes them. This prediction leads to a feeling. Highlight the benefits of avoiding a bad habit to make it seem unattractive. Habits are attractive when we associate them with positive feelings and unattractive when we associate them with negative feelings. Create a motivation ritual by doing something you enjoy immediately before a difficult habit. Now that we have finished our discussion of the second law, let's summarize what we have covered and how to apply it to both creating a good habit and breaking a bad habit. How to create a good habit. The first law is make it obvious. Application 1.1, fill out the habit scorecard. Write down your current habits to become aware of them. Application 1.2, use implementation intentions by filling out the following formula. I will, behavior, at time, in location. Application 1.3, utilize habit stacking by filling out a sentence like, after current habit, I will, new habit. Design your environment by making the cues of your good habits obvious and visible. The second law is make it attractive. Application 2.1, use temptation bundling by pairing an action you want to do with an action you need to do. Application 2.2, join a culture where your desired behavior is the normal behavior. Application 2.3, create a motivation ritual by doing something you enjoy immediately before a difficult habit. And how to break a bad habit? This is the inversion of the second law, which is make it unattractive. Application 2.4, reframe your mindset. Highlight the benefits of avoiding your bad habits. You can download a printable version of this cheat sheet, which covers all 4 laws and their applications, at atomichabits.com/cheat sheet. The third law, make it easy. Chapter 11, walk slowly, but never backward. On the first day of class, Jerry Ulisman, a professor at the University of Florida, divided his film photography students into 2 groups. Everyone on the left side of the classroom, he explained, would be in the quantity group. They would be graded solely on the amount of work they produced. On the final day of class, he would tally the number of photos submitted by each student. 100 photos would rate an A, 90 photos a B, 80 photos a C, and so on. Meanwhile, everyone on the right side of the classroom would be in the quality group. They would be graded only on the excellence of their work. They would only need to produce 1 photo during the semester, but to get an A, it had to be a nearly perfect image. At the end of the term, he was surprised to find that all of the best photos were produced by the quantity group. During the semester, these students were busy taking photos, experimenting with composition and lighting, testing out various methods in the darkroom, and learning from their mistakes. In the process of creating hundreds of photos, they honed their skills. Meanwhile, the quality group sat around speculating about perfection. In the end, they had little to show for their efforts other than unverified theories and 1 mediocre photo. As a side note, a similar story is told in the book Art and Fear by David Bales and Ted Orland. This version has been adapted with permission. You can see the endnotes for a full explanation. It is easy to get bogged down trying to find the optimal plan for change. The fastest way to lose weight, the best program to build muscle, the perfect idea for a side hustle. We are so focused on figuring out the best approach that we never get around to taking action. As Voltaire once wrote, "The best is the enemy of the good." I refer to this as the difference between being in motion and taking action. The two ideas sound similar, but they're not the same. When you're in motion, you're planning and strategizing and learning. And those are all good things, but they don't produce a result. Action, on the other hand, is the type of behavior that will deliver an outcome. If I outline 20 ideas for articles I want to write, that's motion. If I actually sit down and write an article, that's action. If I search for a better diet plan and read a few books on the topic, that's motion. If I actually eat a healthy meal, that's action. Sometimes motion is useful, but it will never produce an outcome by itself. It doesn't matter how many times you go to talk to the personal trainer at the gym. That motion will never get you in shape. Only the action of stepping under the bar and working out will lead to the results you're looking to achieve. If motion doesn't lead to results, then why do we do it? Well, sometimes we do it because we actually need to plan and learn more. But more often than not, we do it because motion allows us to feel like we're making progress without running the risk of failure. Most of us are experts at avoiding criticism. It doesn't feel good to fail or to be judged publicly, so we tend to avoid situations where that might happen. And that's the biggest reason why you may slip into motion rather than take action. You want to delay failure. It's easy to be in motion and convince yourself that you're still making progress. You think, "I've got conversations going with 4 potential clients right now. This is good. We're moving in the right direction." Or, "I brainstormed some ideas for that book I want to write. This is coming together." Motion makes you feel like you're getting things done, but really, you're just preparing to get something done. And when preparation becomes a form of procrastination, you need to change something. You don't want to be merely planning. You want to be practicing. If you want to master a habit, the key is to start with repetition, not perfection. You don't need to map out every feature of a new habit. You just need to practice it. This is the first takeaway of the third law of behavior change. You just need to get your reps in. How long does it actually take to form a new habit? Habit formation is the process by which a behavior becomes progressively more automatic through repetition. The more you repeat an activity, the more the structure of your brain changes to become efficient at that activity. Neuroscientists call this long-term potentiation, which refers to the strengthening of connections between neurons in the brain based on recent patterns of activity. With each repetition, cell-to-cell signaling improves and the neural connections tighten. This was first described by neuropsychologist Donald Hebb in 1949, and the phenomenon is commonly known as Hebb's Law. Neurons that fire together wire together. Repeating a habit leads to clear physical changes in the brain. In musicians, the cerebellum, a brain region critical for physical movements like plucking a guitar string or pulling a violin bow, is larger than in non-musicians. Mathematicians, meanwhile, have increased gray matter in the inferior parietal lobule, which plays a key role in computation and calculation. Its size is directly correlated with the amount of time spent in the field. The older and more experienced the mathematician, the greater the increase in gray matter. When scientists analyzed the brains of taxi drivers in London, they found that the hippocampus, a region of the brain involved in spatial memory, was significantly larger in their subjects than in non-taxi drivers. Even more fascinating, the hippocampus decreased in size when a driver retired. Like the muscles of the body responding to regular weight training, particular regions of the brain adapt as they are used and atrophy as they are abandoned. Of course, the importance of repetition in establishing habits was recognized long before neuroscientists began poking around. In 1860, the English philosopher George H. Lewis noted, "In learning to speak a new language, to play on a musical instrument, or to perform unaccustomed movements, great difficulty is felt, because the channels through which each sensation has to pass have not become established. But no sooner has frequent repetition cut a pathway than this difficulty vanishes. The actions become so automatic that they can be performed while the mind is otherwise engaged." So, both common sense and scientific evidence agree, repetition is actually a form of change. Every time you repeat an action, you are activating a particular neural circuit associated with that habit. And this means simply putting in your reps is one of the most critical steps you can take to encoding a new habit. It is why the students who took tons of photos improved their skills, while those who merely theorized about perfect photos did not. One group engaged in active practice, the other in passive learning. One in action, the other in motion. All habits follow a similar trajectory, from effortful practice to automatic behavior, a process known as automaticity. Automaticity is the ability to perform a behavior without thinking about each step, which occurs when the non-conscious mind takes over. You can see a few graphical representations of what this looks like at atomichabits.com/media. As a habit is repeated, it gradually becomes more and more automatic, and the shape of these charts, the shape of this curve, is what scientists call learning curves. These learning curves reveal an important truth about behavior change. Habits form based on frequency, not time. One of the most common questions I hear is, how long does it take to build a new habit? But what people really should be asking is, how many does it take to form a new habit? That is, how many repetitions are required to make a habit automatic? There's nothing magical about time passing with regard to habit formation. It doesn't matter if it's been 21 days or 30 days or 300 days. What matters is the rate at which you perform the behavior. You could do something twice in 30 days or 200 times, and it's the frequency that makes the difference. Your current habits have been internalized over the course of hundreds, if not thousands, of repetitions. New habits require the same level of frequency. You need to string together enough successful attempts until the behavior is firmly embedded in your mind. In practice, it doesn't really matter how long it takes for a habit to become automatic. What matters is that you take the actions you need to take to make progress. Whether an action is fully automatic is of less importance. The key point is that to build a habit, you need to practice it. And the most effective way to make practice happen is to adhere to the third law of behavior change. Make it easy. The chapters that follow will show you how to do exactly that. Chapter summary. The third law of behavior change is make it easy. The most effective form of learning is practice, not planning. Focus on taking action, not being in motion. Habit formation is the process by which a behavior becomes progressively more automatic through repetition. The amount of time you have spent performing a habit is not as important as the number of times you have performed it. Chapter 12, The Law of Least Effort. In his award-winning book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, anthropologist and biologist Jared Diamond points out a simple fact. Different continents have different shapes. At first glance, this statement seems rather obvious and unimportant, but it turns out to have a profound impact on human behavior. The primary axis of the Americas runs from north to south. That is, the landmass of North and South America tends to be tall and thin rather than wide and fat. The same is generally true for Africa. Meanwhile, the landmass that makes up Europe, Asia, and the Middle East is the opposite. This massive stretch of land tends to be more east-west in shape. According to Diamond, this difference in shape played a significant role in the spread of agriculture over the centuries. When agriculture began to spread around the globe, farmers had an easier time expanding along east-west routes than along north-south ones. This is because locations along the same latitude generally share similar climates, amounts of sunlight and rainfall, and changes in season. These factors allowed farmers in Europe and Asia to domesticate a few crops and grow them along the entire stretch of land from France to China. By comparison, the climate varies greatly when traveling from north to south. Just imagine how different the weather is in Florida compared to Canada. You can be the most talented farmer in the world, but it won't help you grow Florida oranges in the Canadian winter. Snow is a poor substitute for soil. In order to spread crops along north-south routes, farmers would need to find and domesticate new plants whenever the climate changed. As a result, agriculture spread 2 to 3 times faster across Asia and Europe than it did up and down the Americas. Over the span of centuries, this small difference had a very big impact. Increased food production allowed for more rapid population growth. With more people, these cultures were able to build stronger armies and were better equipped to develop new technologies. The changes started out small. A crop that spread slightly farther, a population that grew slightly faster, but compounded into substantial differences over time. The spread of agriculture provides an example of the third law of behavior change on a global scale. Conventional wisdom holds that motivation is the key to habit change. Maybe if you really wanted it, you'd actually do it. But the truth is, our real motivation is to be lazy and to do what is convenient. And despite whatever the latest productivity bestseller will tell you, this is a smart strategy, not a dumb one. Energy is precious, and the brain is wired to conserve it whenever possible. It is human nature to follow the law of least effort, which states that when deciding between two similar options, people will naturally gravitate toward the option that requires the least amount of work. This idea is actually a foundational principle in physics, where it is known as the principle of least action. It states that the path followed between any two points will always be the path requiring the least amount of energy. This simple principle underpins the laws of the universe, and from this one idea, you can describe the laws of motion and relativity. In any case, people are wired to do what is convenient. For example, expanding your farm to the east, where you can grow the same crops, rather than heading north, where the climate is different. Out of all the possible actions we could take, the one that is realized is the one that delivers the most value for the least effort. We are motivated to do what is easy. Every action requires a certain amount of energy. The more energy required, the less likely it is to occur. If your goal is to do 100 push-ups per day, well, that's a lot of energy. In the beginning, when you're motivated and excited, you can muster the strength to get started. But after a few days, such a massive effort feels exhausting. Meanwhile, sticking to the habit of doing one push-up per day requires almost no energy to get started. And the less energy a habit requires, the more likely it is to occur. Look at any behavior that fills up much of your life, and you'll see that it can be performed with very low levels of motivation. Habits like scrolling on our phones, checking email, and watching television steal so much of our time because they can be performed almost without effort. They are remarkably convenient. In a sense, every habit is just an obstacle to getting what you really want. Dieting is an obstacle to getting fit. Meditation is an obstacle to feeling calm. Journaling is an obstacle to thinking clearly. You don't actually want the habit itself. What you really want is the outcome the habit delivers. And the greater the obstacle, that is, the more difficult the habit, the more friction there is between you and your desired end state. This is why it is crucial to make your habits so easy that you'll do them even when you don't feel like it. If you can make your good habits more convenient, you'll be more likely to follow through on them. All right, but what about all the moments when we seem to do the opposite? If we're also lazy, then how do you explain accomplishing hard things like raising a child or starting a business or climbing Mount Everest? Look, certainly you are capable of doing very hard things. The problem is that some days you feel like doing the hard work and some days you feel like giving in. On the tough days, it's crucial to have as many things working in your favor as possible so that you can overcome the challenges life naturally throws your way. The less friction you face, the easier it is for your stronger self to emerge. The idea behind make it easy is not to only do easy things. The idea is to make it as easy as possible in the moment to do the things that pay off in the long run. How to achieve more with less effort. Imagine you are holding a garden hose that is bent in the middle. Some water can flow through, but not very much. If you want to increase the rate at which water passes through the hose, you have two options. The first option is to crank up the valve and force more water out. The second option is to simply remove the bend in the hose and let water flow through naturally. Trying to pump up your motivation to stick with a hard habit is like trying to force water through a bent hose. You can do it, but it requires a lot of effort and it increases the tension in your life. Meanwhile, making your habits simple and easy is like removing the bend in the hose. Rather than trying to overcome the friction in your life, you simply reduce it. One of the most effective ways to reduce the friction associated with your habits is to practice environment design. In Chapter 6, we discussed environment design as a method for making cues more obvious, but you can also optimize your environment to make actions easier. For example, when deciding where to practice a new habit, it is best to choose a place that is already along the path of your daily routine. Habits are easier to build when they fit into the flow of your life. You are more likely to go to the gym if it's on your way to work because stopping doesn't add much friction to your lifestyle. By comparison, if the gym is off the path of your normal commute, even by just a few blocks, now you're going out of your way to get there. Perhaps even more effective is reducing the friction within your home or office. Too often, we try to start habits in high-friction environments. We try to follow a strict diet while we are out to dinner with friends. or we try to write a book in a chaotic household. We try to concentrate while using a smartphone filled with distractions. It doesn't have to be this way. We can remove the points of friction that hold us back. This is precisely what electronics manufacturers in Japan began to do in the 1970s. In an article published in The New Yorker titled Better All the Time, James Surowiecki writes, Japanese firms emphasized what came to be known as lean production, relentlessly looking to remove waste of all kinds from the production process, down to redesigning workspaces so workers didn't have to waste time twisting and turning to reach their tools. The result was that Japanese factories were more efficient and Japanese products were more reliable than American ones. In 1974, service calls for American-made color televisions were five times as common as Japanese televisions. By 1979, it took American workers three times as long to assemble their sets. I like to refer to this strategy as addition by subtraction. The Japanese companies looked for every point of friction in the manufacturing process and eliminated it. As they subtracted wasted effort, they added customers and revenue. Similarly, when we remove the points of friction that sap our time and energy, we can achieve more with less effort. This is one reason tidying up can feel so good. We are simultaneously moving forward and lightening the cognitive load our environment places on us. If you look at the most habit-forming products, you'll notice that one of the things these goods and services do best is remove little points of friction from your life. Meal delivery services reduce the friction of shopping for groceries. Dating apps reduce the friction of making social introductions. Ride-sharing services reduce the friction of getting across town. Text messaging reduces the friction of sending a letter in the mail. Like a Japanese television manufacturer redesigning their workspace to reduce wasted motion, successful companies design their products to automate, eliminate, or simplify as many steps as possible. They reduce the number of fields on each form. They pare down the number of clicks required to create an account. They deliver their products with easy-to-understand directions or ask their customers to make fewer choices. When the first voice-activated speakers were released, products like Google Home, Amazon Echo, and Apple HomePod, I asked a friend what he liked about the product he had purchased. He said it was just easier to say, play some country music, than to pull out his phone, open the music app, and pick a playlist. Of course, just a few years earlier, having unlimited access to music in your pocket was a remarkably frictionless behavior compared to driving to the store and buying a CD. Business is a never-ending quest to deliver the same result in an easier fashion. Similar strategies have been used effectively by governments. When the British government wanted to increase tax collection rates, they switched from sending citizens to a web page where the tax form could be downloaded to linking directly to the form. Reducing that one step in the process increased the response rate from 19.2% to 23.4%. For a country like the United Kingdom, those percentage points represent millions in tax revenue. The central idea is to create an environment where doing the right thing is as easy as possible. Much of the battle of building better habits comes down to finding ways to reduce the friction associated with our good habits and increase the friction associated with our bad ones. Prime the environment for future use. Oswald Knuckles is an IT developer from Natchez, Mississippi. He is also someone who understands the power of priming his environment. Knuckles dialed in his cleaning habits by following a simple strategy he referred to as resetting the room. For instance, when he finishes watching television, he places the remote back on the TV stand, arranges the pillows on the couch, and folds the blanket. When he leaves his car, he throws any trash away. Whenever he takes a shower, he wipes down the toilet while the shower is warming up. As he notes, the perfect time to clean the toilet is right before you wash yourself in the shower anyway. The purpose of resetting each room is not simply to clean up after the last action, but to prepare for the next action. When I walk into a room, everything is in its right place, Knuckles wrote. Because I do this every day, in every room, stuff always stays in good shape. People think I work hard, but I'm actually really lazy. I'm just proactively lazy. It gives you so much time back. Whenever you organize a space for its intended purpose, you are priming it to make the next action easy. For instance, my wife keeps a box of greeting cards that are pre-sorted by occasion, birthday, sympathy, wedding, graduation, and more. Whenever necessary, she grabs the appropriate card and sends it off. She is incredibly good at remembering to send cards because she has reduced the friction of doing so. For years, I was the opposite. Someone would have a baby and I would think, I should send a card. But then weeks would pass, and by the time I remembered to pick one up at the store, it was too late. The habit wasn't easy. There are many ways to prime your environment so it's ready for immediate use. If you want to cook a healthy breakfast, place the skillet on the stove, set out the cooking spray on the counter, and lay out any plates and utensils you need the night before. When you wake up, making breakfast will be easy. Want to draw more? Put your pencils, pens, notebooks, and drawing tools on top of your desk, within easy reach. Want to exercise? Set out your workout clothes, shoes, gym bag, and water bottle ahead of time. Want to improve your diet? Chop up a ton of fruits and vegetables on weekends and pack them in containers, so you have easy access to healthy, ready-to-eat options during the week. These are simple ways to make the good habit the path of least resistance. You can also invert this principle and prime the environment to make bad behaviors difficult. If you find yourself watching too much television, for example, then unplug it after each use. Only plug it back in if you can say out loud the name of the show you want to watch. This setup creates just enough friction to prevent mindless viewing. And if that doesn't do it, you can take it a step further. Unplug the television and take the batteries out of the remote after each use, so it takes an extra 10 seconds to turn it back on. And if you're really hardcore, you could move the television out of the living room and into a closet after each use. You can be sure you'll only take it out when you really want to watch something. The greater the friction, the less likely the habit. Whenever possible, I leave my phone in a different room until lunch. When it's right next to me, I'll check it all morning for no reason at all. But when it's in another room, I rarely think about it. And the friction is high enough that I won't go get it without a reason. As a result, I get 3 to 4 hours each morning when I can work without interruption. If sticking your phone in another room doesn't seem like enough, tell a friend or a family member to hide it from you for a few hours. Ask a coworker to keep it at their desk for the morning and give it back to you at lunch. It is remarkable how little friction is required to prevent unwanted behavior. When I hide beer in the back of the fridge where I can't see it, I drink less. When I delete social media apps from my phone, it can be weeks before I download them again and log in. These tricks are unlikely to curb a true addiction, but for many of us, a little bit of friction can be the difference between sticking with a good habit or sliding into a bad one. Imagine the cumulative impact of making dozens of these changes and living in an environment designed to make the good behaviors easier and the bad behaviors harder. Whether we are approaching behavior change as an individual, a parent, a coach, or a leader, we should ask ourselves the same question. How can we design a world where it is easy to do what is right? Redesign your life so the actions that matter most are also the actions that are easiest to do. Chapter summary. Human behavior follows the law of least effort. We will naturally gravitate toward the option that requires the least amount of work. Create an environment where doing the right thing is as easy as possible. Reduce the friction associated with good behaviors. When friction is low, habits are easy. Increase the friction associated with bad behaviors. When friction is high, habits are difficult. Prime your environment to make future actions easier. Chapter 13. How to Stop Procrastinating by Using the 2-Minute Rule. Twyla Tharp is widely regarded as one of the greatest dancers and choreographers of the modern era. In 1992, she was awarded a MacArthur Fellowship, often referred to as the Genius Grant, and she has spent the bulk of her career touring the globe to perform her original works. She also credits much of her success to simple daily habits. "I begin each day of my life with a ritual," she writes. "I wake up at 5:30 a.m., put on my workout clothes, my leg warmers, my sweatshirt, and my hat. I walk outside my Manhattan home, hail a taxi, and tell the driver to take me to the Pumping Iron Gym at 91st Street and 1st Avenue, where I work out for 2 hours. The ritual is not the stretching and weight training I put my body through each morning at the gym. The ritual is the cab. The moment I tell the driver where to go, I have completed the ritual. It's a simple act, but doing it the same way each morning habitualizes it, makes it repeatable, easy to do. It reduces the chance that I would skip it or do it differently. It is one more item in my arsenal of routines and one less thing to think about." Hailing a cab each morning may be a tiny action, but it is a splendid example of the third law of behavior change. Researchers estimate that 40 to 50% of our actions on any given day are done out of habit. This is already a substantial percentage, but the true influence of your habits is even greater than these numbers suggest. Habits are automatic choices that influence the conscious decisions that follow. Yes, a habit can be completed in just a few seconds, but it can also shape the actions you take for minutes or even hours afterward. Habits are like the entrance ramp to a highway. They lead you down a path, and before you know it, you're speeding toward the next behavior. It seems to be easier to continue what you are already doing than to start doing something different. You sit through a bad movie for 2 hours. You keep snacking even when you're already full. You check your phone for just a second, and soon you've spent 20 minutes staring at the screen. In this way, the habits you follow without thinking often determine the choices you make when you are thinking. Each evening, there is a tiny moment, usually around 5:15 p.m., that shapes the rest of my night. My wife walks in the door from work, and either we change into our workout clothes and head to the gym, or we crash onto the couch, order Indian food, and watch The Office. Now, to be fair, this still sounds like an amazing night, but similar to Twyla Tharp hailing the cab, the ritual is changing into my workout clothes. If I change my clothes, I know the workout will happen. Everything that follows, driving to the gym, deciding which exercises to do, stepping under the bar, is easy once I've taken the first step. Every day there are a handful of moments that deliver an outsized impact. I refer to these little choices as decisive moments. The moment you decide between ordering takeout or cooking dinner. The moment you choose between driving your car or riding your bike. The moment you decide between starting your homework or grabbing the video game controller. These choices are a fork in the road. The difference between a good day and a bad day is often a few productive and healthy choices made at decisive moments. Decisive moments set the options available to your future self. For instance, walking into a restaurant is a decisive moment because it determines what you'll be eating for lunch. Technically, you are in control of what you order, but in a larger sense, you can only order an item if it's on the menu. If you walk into a steakhouse, you can get a sirloin or a ribeye, but not sushi. Your options are constrained by what's available. They are shaped by the first choice. In a similar way, we are limited by where our habits lead us. This is why mastering the decisive moments throughout your day is so important. Each day is made up of many moments, but it is really a few habitual choices that determine the path you take. These little choices stack up, each one setting the trajectory for how you spend the next chunk of time. Habits are the entry point, not the end point. They are the cab, not the gym. The 2-minute rule. Even when you know you should start small, it's easy to start too big. When you dream about making a change, excitement inevitably takes over and you end up trying to do too much too soon. The most effective way I know to counteract this tendency is to use the 2-minute rule, which states, when you start a new habit, it should take less than 2 minutes to do. You'll find that nearly any habit can be scaled down into a 2-minute version. Read before bed each night becomes read one page. Do 30 minutes of yoga becomes take out my yoga mat. Study for class becomes open my notes. Fold the laundry becomes fold one pair of socks. Run 3 miles becomes tie my running shoes. The idea is to make your habits as easy as possible to start. Anyone can meditate for 1 minute, read one page, or put one item of clothing away. And as we have just discussed, this is a powerful strategy because once you have started doing the right thing, it is much easier to continue doing it. A new habit should not feel like a challenge. The actions that follow can be challenging, but the first 2 minutes should be easy. What you want is a gateway habit that naturally leads you down a more productive path. You can usually figure out the gateway habits that will lead to your desired outcome by mapping out your goals on a scale from very easy to very hard. For instance, running a marathon is very hard. Running a 5K is hard. Walking 10,000 steps is moderately difficult. Walking 10 minutes is easy. And putting on your running shoes is very easy. So your goal might be to run a marathon, but your gateway habit is to put on your running shoes. That's how you follow the 2-minute rule. People often think it's weird to get hyped about reading one page or meditating for 1 minute or making one sales call, but the point is not to do one thing. The point is to master the habit of showing up. The truth is, a habit must be established before it can be improved. If you can't learn the basic skill of showing up, then you have little hope of mastering the finer details. Instead of trying to engineer a perfect habit from the start, do the easy thing on a more consistent basis. You have to standardize before you can optimize. As you master the art of showing up, the first 2 minutes simply become a ritual at the beginning of a larger routine. This is not merely a hack to make your habits easier, but actually the ideal way to master a difficult skill. The more you ritualize the beginning of a process, the more likely it becomes that you can slip into the state of deep focus that is required to do great things. By doing the same warm-up before every workout, you make it easier to get into a state of peak performance. By following the same creative ritual, you make it easier to get into the hard work of creating. By developing a consistent power-down habit, you make it easier to get to bed at a reasonable time each night. You may not be able to automate the whole process, but you can make the first action mindless. Make it easy to start, and the rest will follow. The 2-minute rule can seem like a trick to some people. You know that the real goal is to do it for more than just 2 minutes, so it may feel like you're trying to fool yourself. Nobody is actually aspiring to read one page or do one push-up or open their notes. And if you know it's a mental trick, well then why would you fall for it? If the 2-minute rule feels forced, try this. Do it for 2 minutes and then stop. Go for a run, but you must stop after 2 minutes. Start meditating, but you must stop after 2 minutes. Study Arabic, but you must stop after 2 minutes. It's not a strategy for starting, it's the whole thing. Your habit can only last 120 seconds. One of my readers used this strategy to lose over 100 pounds. In the beginning, he went to the gym each day, but he told himself he wasn't allowed to stay at the gym for more than 5 minutes. He would show up, exercise for 5 minutes, and leave as soon as his time was up. After a few weeks, he looked around and thought, well, I'm coming here all the time anyway, I may as well start staying a little longer. And a few years later, the weight was gone. Journaling provides another example. Nearly everyone can benefit from getting their thoughts out of their head and onto paper, but most people give up after a few days, or avoid it entirely, because journaling feels like a chore. The secret is to always stay below the point where it feels like work. Greg McCown, a leadership consultant from the United Kingdom, built a daily journaling habit by specifically writing less than he felt like. He always stopped journaling before it seemed like a hassle. Ernest Hemingway believed in similar advice for any kind of writing. The best way is to always stop when you are going good, he said. I actually designed a habit journal specifically to make journaling easier. It includes a one-line-per-day section where you simply write one sentence about your day. It's the easiest way to start a journaling habit. You can learn more at atomichabits.com/journal. Strategies like this work for another reason, too. They reinforce the identity you want to build. If you show up at the gym 5 days in a row, even if it's just for 2 minutes, you are casting votes for your new identity. You're not worried about getting in shape. You're focused on becoming the type of person who doesn't miss workouts. You're taking the smallest action that confirms the type of person you want to be. We rarely think about change this way because everyone is consumed by the end goal. But one push-up is better than not exercising. 1 minute of guitar practice is better than none at all. 1 minute of reading is better than never picking up a book. It's better to do less than you hoped than to do nothing at all. At some point, once you've established the habit and you're showing up each day, you can combine the 2-minute rule with a technique we call habit shaping to scale your habit back up toward your ultimate goal. You start by mastering the first 2 minutes of the smallest version of the behavior. Then you advance to an intermediate step and repeat the process, focusing on just the first 2 minutes and mastering that stage before moving on to the next level. Eventually, you'll end up with the habit you had originally hoped to build while still keeping your focus where it should be, on the first 2 minutes of the behavior. Here are some examples of habit shaping. If you want to become an early riser, phase one might be home at 10 p.m. every night. Phase two, have all devices, television, phone, and so on, turned off by 10 p.m. every night. Phase three, be in bed by 10 p.m. every night. Phase four, lights off by 10 p.m. every night. Phase five, wake up at 6 a.m. every day. At each of the five stages, you focus on mastering the first 2 minutes of the habit. Or imagine that you want to start an exercise habit. Phase one might be changing into your workout clothes. Phase two could be step out the door. Phase three could be driving to the gym and exercising for 5 minutes. Phase four, exercise for 15 minutes at least once a week. And finally, phase five, exercise 3 times a week. Nearly any larger life goal can be transformed into a 2-minute behavior. For example, I want to live a healthy and long life becomes I need to stay in shape, which translates to I need to exercise, which breaks down to I need to change into my workout clothes. Or I want to have a happy marriage becomes I need to be a good partner, which translates to I should do something each day to make my partner's life easier, which leads to I should meal plan for next week. Whenever you're struggling to stick with a habit, you can employ the 2-minute rule. It is a simple way to make your habits easy. Chapter summary. Habits can be completed in a few seconds, but continue to impact your behavior for minutes or hours afterward. Many habits occur at decisive moments, choices that are like a fork in the road, and either send you in the direction of a productive day or an unproductive one. The 2-minute rule states, when you start a new habit, it should take less than 2 minutes to do. The more you ritualize the beginning of a process, the more likely it becomes that you can slip into the state of deep focus that is required to do great things. Standardize before you optimize. You can't improve a habit that doesn't exist. Chapter 14. How to make good habits inevitable and bad habits impossible. In the summer of 1830, Victor Hugo was facing an impossible deadline. 12 months earlier, the French author had promised his publisher a new book. But instead of writing, he spent that year pursuing other projects, entertaining guests, and delaying his work. Frustrated, Hugo's publisher responded by setting a deadline less than 6 months away. The book had to be finished by February of 1831. Hugo concocted a strange plan to beat his procrastination. He collected all of his clothes and asked an assistant to lock them away in a large chest. He was left with nothing to wear except a large shawl. Lacking any suitable clothing to go outdoors, he remained in his study and wrote furiously during the fall and winter of 1830. The Hunchback of Notre Dame was published 2 weeks early, on January 14, 1831. The irony of how closely the story matches my process for writing this book is not lost on me. Although my publisher was much more accommodating and my closet remained full, I did feel like I had to place myself on house arrest to finish the manuscript. Sometimes success is less about making good habits easy and more about making bad habits hard. This is an inversion of the third law of behavior change. Make it difficult. If you find yourself continually struggling to follow through on your plans, then you can take a page from Victor Hugo and make your bad habits more difficult by creating what psychologists call a commitment device. A commitment device is a choice you make in the present that controls your actions in the future. It is a way to lock in future behavior, bind you to good habits, and restrict you from bad ones. When Victor Hugo shut his clothes away so he could focus on writing, he was creating a commitment device. This is also referred to as a Ulysses Pact or a Ulysses Contract, named after Ulysses, the hero of the Odyssey, who told his sailors to tie him to the mast of the ship so he could hear the enchanting songs of the sirens, but wouldn't be able to steer the ship toward them and crash on the rocks. Ulysses realized the benefits of locking in your future actions while your mind is in the right place, rather than waiting to see where your desires will take you in the moment. There are many ways to create a commitment device. You can reduce overeating by purchasing food in individual packages rather than in bulk size. You can voluntarily ask to be added to the banned list at casinos and online poker sites to prevent future gambling sprees. I've even heard of athletes who have to make weight for a competition, choosing to leave their wallets at home during the week before weigh-in so they won't be tempted to buy fast food. As another example, my friend and fellow habits expert Nir Eyal purchased an outlet timer, which is an adapter that he plugged in between his internet router and the power outlet. At 10 p.m. each night, the outlet timer cuts off the power to the router, and when the internet goes off, everyone knows it's time to go to bed. Commitment devices are useful because they enable you to take advantage of your good intentions before you can fall victim to temptation. Whenever I'm looking to cut calories, for example, I will ask the waiter to split my meal and box it in half before the meal is served. If I waited until the meal came out and told myself, I'll just eat half, it would never work. The key is to change the task such that it requires more work to get out of the good habit than to get started on it. If you're feeling motivated to get in shape, schedule a yoga session and pay ahead of time. If you're excited about the business you want to start, email an entrepreneur you respect and set up a consulting call. When the time comes to act, the only way to bail is to cancel the meeting, which requires effort and may cost money. Commitment devices increase the odds that you'll do the right thing in the future by making bad habits difficult in the present. However, we can do even better. We can make good habits inevitable and bad habits impossible. How to automate a habit and never think about it again. John Henry Patterson was born in Dayton, Ohio in 1844. He spent his childhood doing chores on the family farm and working shifts at his father's sawmill. After attending college at Dartmouth, Patterson returned to Ohio and opened a small supply store for coal miners. It seemed like a good opportunity. The store faced little competition and enjoyed a steady stream of customers, but it still struggled to make money. That was when Patterson discovered his employees were stealing from him. In the mid-1800s, employee theft was a common problem. Receipts were kept in an open drawer and could easily be altered or discarded. There were no video cameras to review behavior and no software to track transactions. Unless you were willing to hover over your employees every minute of the day, or to manage all transactions yourself, it was difficult to prevent theft. As Patterson mulled over his predicament, he came across an advertisement for a new invention called Ritty's Incorruptible Cashier. Designed by fellow Dayton resident James Ritty, it was the first cash register. The machine automatically locked the cash and receipts inside after each transaction. Patterson bought two for $50 each. Employee theft at his store vanished overnight. In the next 6 months, Patterson's business went from losing money to making $5,000 in profit, the equivalent of more than $100,000 today. Patterson was so impressed with the machine that he changed businesses. He bought the rights to Ritty's invention and opened the National Cash Register Company. 10 years later, National Cash Register had over 1,000 employees and was on its way to becoming one of the most successful businesses of its time. The best way to break a bad habit is to make it impractical to do. Increase the friction until you don't even have the option to act. The brilliance of the cash register was that it automated ethical behavior by making stealing practically impossible. Rather than trying to change the motivations of the employees, it made the preferred behavior automatic. Some actions, like installing a cash register, pay off again and again. These one-time choices require a little bit of effort up front, but create increasing value over time. I'm fascinated by the idea that a single choice can deliver returns again and again, and I surveyed my readers on their favorite one-time actions that lead to better long-term habits. Here are a few examples. One-time actions that lock in good habits. Nutrition. Buy a water filter to clean your drinking water. Use smaller plates to reduce caloric intake. Sleep. Buy a good mattress. Get blackout curtains. Remove your television from your bedroom. Productivity. Unsubscribe from emails. Turn off notifications and mute group chats. Set your phone to silent. Use email filters to clear up your inbox. Delete games and social media apps from your phone. Happiness. Get a dog. Move to a friendly social neighborhood. General health. Get vaccinated. Buy good shoes to avoid back pain. Buy a supportive chair or a standing desk. Finance. Enroll in an automatic savings plan. Set up automatic bill pay. Cut cable service. Call up service providers and ask to lower your bills. I'd wager that if the average person were to simply do half of the one-time actions on this list, even if they didn't give another thought to their habits, most would find themselves living a better life a year from now. These one-time actions are a straightforward way to employ the third law of behavior change. They make it easier to sleep well or eat healthy or be productive, to save money, and generally live better. Of course, there are many ways to automate good habits and eliminate bad ones. Typically, they involve putting technology to work for you. Technology can transform actions that were once hard, annoying, and complicated into behaviors that are easy, painless, and simple. It is the most reliable and effective way to guarantee the right behavior. This is particularly useful for behaviors that happen too infrequently to become habitual. Things you have to do monthly or yearly, like rebalancing your investment portfolio, are never repeated frequently enough to become a habit, so they benefit in particular from technology remembering to do them for you. Other examples include medicine. Prescriptions can be automatically refilled. Or personal finance. Employees can save for retirement with an automatic wage deduction. Cooking. Meal delivery services can do your grocery shopping. Productivity. Social media browsing can be cut off with a website blocker. When you automate as much of your life as possible, you can spend your effort on the tasks machines cannot do yet. Each habit that we hand over to the authority of technology frees up time and energy to pour into the next stage of growth. As mathematician and philosopher Alfred North Whitehead wrote, "Civilization advances by extending the number of operations we can perform without thinking about them." Of course, the power of technology can work against us as well. Binge watching becomes a habit because you have to put more effort into stop looking at the screen than to continue doing so. Instead of pressing a button to advance to the next episode, Netflix or YouTube will autoplay it for you. All you have to do is keep your eyes open. Technology creates a level of convenience that enables you to act on your smallest whims and desires. At the mere suggestion of hunger, you can have food delivered to your door. At the slightest hint of boredom, you can get lost in the vast expanse of social media. When the effort required to act on your desires becomes effectively zero, you can find yourself slipping into whatever impulse arises at the moment. The downside of automation is that we can find ourselves jumping from easy task to easy task without making time for more difficult, but ultimately more rewarding, work. I often find myself gravitating towards social media during any downtime. If I feel bored for just a fraction of a second, I reach for my phone. It's easy to write off these minor distractions as just taking a break, but over time they can accumulate into a serious issue. The constant tug of just one more minute can prevent me from doing anything of consequence. I'm not the only one. The average person spends over 2 hours per day on social media. What could you do with an extra 600 hours per year? During the year I was writing this book, I experimented with a new time management strategy. Every Monday, my assistant would reset the passwords on all my social media accounts, which logged me out on each device. All week, I worked without distraction. On Friday, she would send me the new passwords. I had the entire weekend to enjoy what social media had to offer until Monday morning, when she would do it again. If you don't have an assistant, you can team up with a friend or family member and reset each other's passwords each week. One of the biggest surprises was how quickly I adapted. Within the first week of locking myself out of social media, I realized that I didn't need to check it nearly as often as I had been, and I certainly didn't need it each day. It had simply been so easy that it had become the default. Once my bad habit became impossible, I discovered that I did actually have the motivation to work on more meaningful tasks. After I removed the mental candy from my environment, it became much easier to eat the healthy stuff. When working in your favor, automation can make your good habits inevitable and your bad habits impossible. It is the ultimate way to lock in future behavior rather than relying on willpower in the moment. By utilizing commitment devices, strategic one-time decisions, and technology, you can create an environment of inevitability, a space where good habits are not just an outcome you hope for, but an outcome that is virtually guaranteed. Chapter summary. The inversion of the third law of behavior change is make it difficult. A commitment device is a choice you make in the present that locks in better behavior in the future. The ultimate way to lock in future behavior is to automate your habits. One-time choices, like buying a better mattress or enrolling in an automatic savings plan, are single actions that automate your future habits and deliver increasing returns over time. Using technology to automate your habits is the most reliable and effective way to guarantee the right behavior. Now that we have concluded our discussion of the third law of behavior change, let me summarize how to create a good habit and how to create a bad one. The third law of behavior change is make it easy. Application 3.1, reduce friction. Decrease the number of steps between you and your good habits. Application 3.2, prime the environment. Prepare your environment to make future actions easier. Application 3.3, master the decisive moment. Optimize the small choices that deliver outsized impact. Application 3.4, use the 2-minute rule. Downscale your habits until they can be done in 2 minutes or less. Application 3.5, automate your habits. Invest in technology and one-time purchases that lock in future behavior. And we can invert the third law of behavior change to discuss how to break a bad habit. The inversion of the third law is make it difficult. Application 3.6, increase friction. Increase the number of steps between you and your bad habits. Application 3.7, use a commitment device. Restrict your future choices to the ones that benefit you. You can download a complete version of this cheat sheet on how to create a good habit and how to break a bad habit at atomichabits.com/cheat sheet. The fourth law, make it satisfying. Chapter 15, the cardinal rule of behavior change. In the late 1990s, a public health worker named Stephen Luby left his hometown of Omaha, Nebraska, and bought a one-way ticket to Karachi, Pakistan. Karachi was one of the most populous cities in the world. By 1998, over 9 million people called it home. It was the economic center of Pakistan and a transportation hub, with some of the most active airports and seaports in the region. In the commercial parts of town, you could find all of the standard urban amenities and bustling downtown streets. But Karachi was also one of the least livable cities in the world. Over 60% of Karachi's residents lived in squatter settlements and slums. These densely packed neighborhoods were filled with makeshift houses, cobbled together with old boards, cinder blocks, and other discarded materials. There was no waste removal system, no electricity grid, no clean water supply. When dry, the streets were a combination of dust and trash. When wet, they became the muddy pit of sewage. Mosquito colonies thrived in pools of stagnant water, and children played among the garbage. The unsanitary conditions led to widespread illness and disease. Contaminated water sources caused epidemics of diarrhea, vomiting, and abdominal pain. Nearly one-third of the children living there were malnourished. With so many people crammed into such a small space, viruses and bacterial infections spread rapidly. It was this public health crisis that had brought Stephen Luby to Pakistan. Luby and his team realized that in an environment with poor sanitation, the simple habit of washing your hands could make a real difference in the health of the residents. But they soon discovered that many people were already aware that hand washing was important. And yet, despite this knowledge, many residents were washing their hands in a haphazard fashion. Some people would just run their hands under the water quickly. Others would only wash one hand. Many would simply forget to wash their hands before preparing food. Everyone said hand washing was important, but few people made a habit out of it. The problem wasn't knowledge. The problem was consistency. That was when Luby and his team partnered with Procter & Gamble to supply the neighborhood with Safeguard soap. Compared to your standard bar of soap, using Safeguard was a much more enjoyable experience. In Pakistan, Safeguard was a premium soap, Luby told me. The study participants commonly mentioned how much they liked it. The soap foamed easily and people were able to lather their hands with suds. It smelled great. Instantly, hand washing became slightly more pleasurable. I see the goal of hand washing promotion not as behavior change, but as habit adoption, Luby said. It is a lot easier for people to adopt a product that provides a strong positive sensory signal, for example, the mint of toothpaste, than it is to adopt a habit that does not provide pleasurable sensory feedback, like flossing one's teeth. The marketing team at Procter & Gamble talked about trying to create a positive hand-washing experience. Within months, the researchers saw a rapid shift in the health of children in the neighborhood. The rate of diarrhea fell by 52%, pneumonia by 48%, and impetigo, a bacterial skin infection, by 35%. The long-term effects were even better. We went back to some of the households in Karachi 6 years after, Luby told me. Over 95% of households who had been given the soap for free and encouraged to wash their hands had a hand-washing station with soap and water available when our study team visited. We had not given any soap to the intervention group for over 5 years, but during the trial, they had become so habituated to wash their hands that they had maintained the practice. It was a powerful example of the fourth and final law of behavior change. Make it satisfying. We are more likely to repeat a behavior when the experience is satisfying. This is entirely logical. Feelings of pleasure, even minor ones like washing your hands with soap that smells nice and lathers well, are signals that tell the brain, this feels good, do this again next time. Pleasure teaches your brain that a behavior is worth remembering and repeating. Take the story of chewing gum. Chewing gum had been sold commercially throughout the 1800s, but it wasn't until Wrigley launched in 1891 that it became a worldwide habit. Early versions were made from relatively bland resins, chewy but not tasty. Wrigley revolutionized the industry by adding flavors like spearmint and juicy fruit, which made the product flavorful and fun to use. Then they went a step further and began pushing chewing gum as a pathway to a clean mouth. Advertisements told readers to, quote, refresh your taste. Tasty flavors and the feeling of a fresh mouth provided little bits of immediate reinforcement and made the product satisfying to use. Consumption skyrocketed, and Wrigley became the largest chewing gum company in the world. Toothpaste had a similar trajectory. Manufacturers enjoyed great success when they added flavors like spearmint, peppermint, and cinnamon to their products. These flavors don't improve the effectiveness of toothpaste. They simply create a clean mouth feel and make the experience of brushing your teeth more pleasurable. My wife actually stopped using Sensodyne because she didn't like the aftertaste. She switched to a brand with a stronger mint flavor, which proved to be more satisfying. Conversely, if an experience is not satisfying, we have little reason to repeat it. In my research, I came across the story of a woman who had a narcissistic relative that drove her nuts. In an attempt to spend less time with this egomaniac, she acted as dull and as boring as possible whenever he was around. Within a few encounters, he started avoiding her because he found her so uninteresting. Stories like these are evidence of the cardinal rule of behavior change. What is rewarded is repeated. What is punished is avoided. You learn what to do in the future based on what you were rewarded for doing or punished for doing in the past. Positive emotions cultivate habits, negative emotions destroy them. The first three laws of behavior change, Make it obvious, make it attractive, and make it easy. Increase the odds that a behavior will be performed this time. The fourth law of behavior change, make it satisfying, increases the odds that a behavior will be repeated next time. It completes the habit loop.